doesn't have any dislocations in it, and so there's nowhere for the rusting to start. And it also has peculiar magnetic properties, peculiar in the sense that the magnetic losses are extremely low in a metallic glass, and so if you use it in a transformer, you gain a little. But, of course, the amount of current going through a transformer is so colossal that in monetary terms you gain a lot. So it's a subject which is developing very quickly, and there are other aspects of this which are not clear yet, but I raised this one particularly because when I was away last week, I went to a meeting which is involved in solar panels, and the thing that's really holding it up is a good way to make glassy semiconductors. At present, they can't do it, and if you could make glassy semiconductors, you'd have, again, a small increase in the efficiency. But you only need a small increase. Right, then here are the two comments which Sid has already discussed. What is the thermodynamic state of glassification, and what is the situation about reaching equilibrium? It is very slow, and the glass ages. Another one that there's been some discussion here about, it's not my scene at all, so I'm just listing it, and that's the kind of jamming that takes place in vortices. And it reminded me that there are very great mysteries involved with plasmas when they do this, because if you have a plasma in a tokamak or one of those kind of machines, an essential feature of its subtlety is that the field lines get entangled with one another, and the flow of the plasma is held by the fact that the field lines don't want to cross one another. And a thing that I've often loved to think about in polymeric systems and in other systems is that if you want to measure the amount of entanglement, and you have a vector potential A in a magnetic field B, then the integral of A dot B is the number of times the field lines wind round one another. I'm sure this is a way of explaining negative pinches, and I'm sure it has something to do with polymers, which is what I'm coming on to now. You know, here's a problem of jamming, and in many ways it's the simplest one to appreciate. Say you have a polymer solution, and that's the logarithm of the viscosity, and that's M is the molecular weight of the polymer, so it's essentially the length of the polymer chain. And you ask, how does it behave? Well, it increases a bit, and it eventually reaches a power of 1. And then there comes a crisis, and it turns from being a solution to being a melt. And at that point, the viscosity goes up like the 3.4 power, that it gets up there, and then it turns into a glass, and to all intents and purposes, the viscosity goes to infinity. Now, this is a very interesting phenomenon, because if you try and look at this kind of thing for small molecules, it's not at all easy to see how to do it. But I do assure you that though there is occasional argument, there's a log-log plot. Is that a point, or is it a smooth transition there? But there really are absolutely clear gradients of 1, gradient of 3.4, and vertically upwards. The interesting thing here is this, that when you look at many systems, the actual transition to immobility is not uniform. In other words, you can say, any experts in the audience here about colloidal flow, but what happens with a colloid is that as you increase the concentration of, from the word colloid, let me substitute little spheres, which will be good enough for this purpose. As you increase the concentration of the little spheres, the viscosity goes up in the Einstein sense. But there comes a point where they can reorganize themselves and start sliding along in sheets. And then they get so dense that the sheets break up, and the thing really does jam, moves very slowly, and eventually doesn't move at all. So as far as I know, this does not occur if we're studying the cooling, shall we say, of SiO2, where the viscosity is uniformly increasing all the time. So things like colloids and things like polymers can be very complex in the way they go into the transition. And I mention another one here, which is an extreme example of this, discovered by Vinogradov. If you send a polymer melt down a narrow tube and you increase the pressure, there suddenly comes a point where the central column of the polymer, the melt, moves much faster. And Vinogradov called it a spurt effect. I think, of course, chemical engineers are familiar with lots of things where things go into plug flow and out of plug flow, and I'll not try to argue what precisely causes this, but I just make the point that there has been theoretical effort on this, and it exemplifies the problem of the subtlety of just how things go into a high viscosity region. Right. Well, that's this comment here is the same one.
How sensitive is this curve you have for the polymers to temperature? Does it just shift around a little bit, or is it?
The temperature simply appears as an external factor, and it doesn't really affect it at all. I've done the whole thing at constant temperature. Now, if you alter the temperature, then what happens? It shifts it, but it doesn't alter the shape at all. It doesn't alter the power 3.4. You see, let me go on and talk about what's actually happening there, because I've got a picture to show you what it means. These regimes for the polymers, you can think of a dilute solution as just floating bits of polymer. And they're really like little balls in Einstein's picture of viscosity, and that gives you this linear region. But once it becomes sufficiently concentrated, when these things overlap, then the polymers, these dots are supposed to be polymers going into the blackboard or the whiteboard or the screen. Then it looks like that, and then you can argue that all these dots are making up some kind of tube, and the polymer is moving in a tube. So when you get to a sufficient concentration, or the polymer is sufficiently long, which amounts to the same thing, then there comes a point where the polymer appears to be confined to a tube. And then it has to move in the motion which de Gennes called reptation down the tube. Now, what happens when you... let me come to your question. Now, the point about the temperature is that the mobility of this object down the tube will increase with increasing temperature. But the tube itself is a kind of geometrical thing, and the temperature doesn't come into it. Now, what happens when you cool the polymer down is that, I'm now pressing this tube concept further probably than it's justified, but you'll start getting pinches in it, and also when the polymer tries to move down the tube, it starts running into other polymers at both ends. So you'll see that the glass transition here can be quite complex in that the motion of the polymer down the tube can cease, but it's still got plenty of room to wriggle around there. It doesn't lose its specific heat. In fact, you really hardly notice the specific heat change. What you do notice, though, is the diffusion and the viscosity of tremendous changes in them. Right, then I'm trying to emphasize the point there with drawing these. At first sight, people would think of polymeric systems as so much more complicated than simple molecules, and you can make a very good glass out of glycerin, but there's smaller things than that. You can get naphthalene, you get a perfectly good glass, and that's a theoretical nightmare. But polymers are dead easy. What I'm not going to talk about is these other topics, which will be covered in the conference and are a major part of our meeting, but I'm sufficiently inexpert in them. Sid has touched on some, and I'm sure Mark will be talking more about them as the conference goes on. Let me then start thinking about theory. How am I doing? Fine. I want to put the view that there are two grand avenues for trying to understand the theory of jamming. One of them is to search for a physical system which happens to be soluble. You see, I've been pushing the polymers as one example of this, but it's not the only one. What we're doing, therefore, is looking to get a theory going. We need to find either a small number or a large number, because then we can try and produce a theory in one over the large number. So here's my sort of slightly Animal Farm description of the world. That is, spheres are bad and strings are good. Right. Well, another example is of which you can get going on a theory is to use Coulombic forces. For example, ferroelectrics are immensely simpler than ferromagnetics. Electrolytes are simpler than other solutions. Not sure about polyelectrolytes. That's been a graveyard for many a brave man. A large number of atoms in the unit cell. The sort of thing I mean here is finding myself very impressed by the work of petrologists. You see, when you look at rocks, we always think of it as rock, NaCl or something like this. But these characters look at things like calcium 45, aluminium 37, oxygen 5.5, and things like this. It's simply amazing. And they are huge unit cells, but given the millions of years that rocks have to do whatever they do, you actually can find them. And then the theories which I suppose we now associate really with a paper of, would it be Landau and Ginzburg? I'm thinking of Landau before the war, 38, where he looks at the many phases in competition. Now, of course, Landau went on in those papers to think that the simple mean field indices were correct, and we know it's much more subtle. But these critical indices are not nearly as important. In petrology, what you're really worried about is the large number of particles in the unit cell. And that does mean that you can solve the thermodynamic problem to a very high level of accuracy. It is the most interesting application of statistical mechanics, which is rather remote from physicists, but geophysicists or petrologists have done very well with it. Did I get to the end of that slide? Oh, no, I didn't. Polymers, I've already mentioned. As the molecular weight goes to infinity, the point then, of course, is that the correlation between one end and the other end of the polymer is 1 over R. It's Coulombic. And therefore, we find that great theorem that makes polymer science so simple, and that is that the chemical structure of the polymer is irrelevant. The only thing that matters is how long it is. Then finally, I mentioned liquid crystal polymers. That is, this is the one where the thing is completely flexible. Liquid crystal polymers tend to be rather stiff and rather straight, and they're even simpler than the others. Right, now then, now I'm beginning to really run my time. The alternative to looking hard at particular physical systems which are easy is to invent mathematical systems which are, if not easy, at least easier. So that one can start studying particular models where there are long-range forces built into an easing model, and you can do mean field theories. Another example is to use a large number of particles in a unit cell, not in a petrological sense, but just making a mathematical hypothesis. And finally, you can always go into a higher number of dimensions. And a lot of statistical mechanics works there, and it's an interesting question as to what extent, I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, and I'm sure that people will correct me if I'm wrong, that people have looked at glass problems in a higher number of dimensions. It ought to be possible to solve them and get unambiguous glass theories, nice easy glass theories, by looking at what happens to a five-dimensional crystal. Of course, such things are remote from experience, to say the least of it, but they can give us hints as to the right way to proceed. Let me go back now and look at polymers and draw your attention to this kind of picture. Here are two pictures. Let's suppose we looked at the modulus as a function of frequency of a polymeric melt. Just a lot of strings in a box. Now what happens is it behaves like a liquid at low frequency. Then there's a plateau, and the plateau comes from the fact that the thing's inside the tube, and the oscillation of the system is faster than the time it takes for the polymer to get out of the tube. So it's as if the polymer is trapped in the tube, and so the thing behaves like a rubber.
But if you...
I'm sorry?
The shear modulus?
Shear modulus, yes, right. Sorry, yes, the shear modulus. And it's a real part. I should say that too. Then, at a certain frequency, you really lose the fact that it's a polymer. You just have individual monomers hitting one another, and that's called the glass region, though I'm not sure that's a very good name for it, but it's what one does. Now, if you look at the diffusion of polymers, what you find is that you get glasses very, very easily. A polymeric system, look around us, all of the things, this itself, you know, these are typical polymeric glasses. If you cool them quickly, this is general comment on all glasses, but it works very clearly with polymers. If you cool it quickly, it'll come down to, it'll be glassifying at a temperature which is above the TG, which you get when the slow cool, and there obviously is a theoretical problem to discuss how exactly that curve differs from that one, and how much this distance is along here. It's really, there's an enormous more detail than this, and it'll be covered properly in this meeting. I'd like now to look at the analogies with... Now, what does this tell me? Someone has put this here to stop the things flying and not to tell me to keep quiet. Is that correct?
We'll put it up on top.
Well, what is it that you...
You're fine.
I'm doing fine, right. I'm going to now go to Sid's picture and talk about that. You remember the picture. You've got a powder. You tap it. And a large number of taps, but the intensity of the tap, the amount of force you put on it is on this axis, and the density is on that axis. If you pour the powder in, you get it a very fluffy condition to start with, like this, and you tap it until it reaches a point here. I'm not going to talk about this part of the curve at all, because you're then hitting it so hard that it's flying up again. Let's go as far as that. And now it's reversible. You make the taps of less intensity, you come back to there. And as Sid said, this looks like... an analogy I like to think of here is what happens if you look at a magnet and you put on a magnetic field or not. Then if you suddenly reverse a magnetic field on a magnetized system, you get, of course, a totally non-thermodynamic state, because all spins are pointing parallel and in the wrong direction. And it breaks up until it reaches a very high temperature level there. And then if you cool it, it'll go down to there. So there ought to be an analogy here, and I'm arguing there is some analogy of a temperature, which I'm calling X, be anything by X. Then X equals naught is that point. It's like the temperature being zero, and the temperature being infinity is there, and this is not part of a thermodynamic system. So it's like setting up the magnetic system with the field and spins entirely in the wrong direction, and the only this bit of it is the one can be discussed in these terms. Now, is there any analogy with an analog of temperature and a single variable? I'm mentioning other things. I'll come back to that. But, Sid, you didn't mention your work here on the force distribution which individual grains make on a wall. I think this is very important, because the probability is something like this. Well, obviously, it's going to come down. But it comes down very slowly. You'd think it would go down e to the minus f squared. It goes down e to the minus f. Another experiment, which is briefly touched on, but we'll have full-scale papers on it later, is that if you have a pile of sand, then what you're going to get is a pressure on the ground, and the pressure often takes this kind of form, and the question is, can one predict this kind of thing? Is it a universal thing, or does it depend on the way that, I'm sure, in fact, it depends on the way the sand pile has been poured.
Why would you think that it's much faster than exponential?
Yeah, well, if you regard it as a random process, then you'd think it would go down like e to the minus f squared. Well, you can imagine that the force that... What's happened to my picture? You could imagine that the force here will be a combination of lots of other forces which are transmitting from here to there. So when you add them all up, what you'll expect is that it's like a Poisson distribution turning into... You're totally skeptical. Well, you have a right to be, because experimentally it's like that. So there you are. Do explain it. We'll all love to hear the answer. I'd like to take, if I've got a minute off, can I follow the point that Sid made? I think it's worth, I hope this doesn't go on the web. This is something I ought to draw. I ought to draw a picture. Now, that shading means sugar. That one means salt. And that one means chalk. Now, imagine you've got a box, and it's got sugar and sand, and you do some tapping so that a membrane or something between the two lands there. Then have another box, and you've got chalk and sugar, and you shake it, and you arrange the amount of material, and I'm not going to go into detail on doing this, but this is an intuitive experiment. You ought to be able to work it all out for yourselves. That thing comes in the same place. Now, the issue is that if you now put salt and chalk together and you arrange it in exactly the same way, will it again come in the same place? Now, to me, it's intuitively obvious that it will come in the same place. Now, I mean, you dig your garden or you cook your cake or, I mean, it always does it. And what is the thing that's the same? Well, it's the V by the S, where V is the volume and S is the entropy. And that, incidentally, is the law you get if you have thermodynamic systems and you went to absolute zero. So my belief is, not, I think, in a sand pile, you will have other variables because of the way it's being deposited. This theory is too simple. But in a homogeneous isotropic system, I think the V by the S is this static temperature and has a great future. Right, now then, I really am beginning to run low on time, I guess. I'll make, let's see, how am I doing? I've lost track completely.
Well, you have 5 or 10 minutes.
5 or 10 minutes. Oh, I'll get there in 5 or 10 minutes. I'd like to put forward now some problems. There's a particular interest. If you take a granular material and you ask, what is a simpler system? And the simplest system will be when the grains are completely hard and have perfect friction, infinite friction. So you just pack them together, and what you find then is a very tiresome thing, that the equations are given by Isaac Newton, no less, and they are indeterminate, and either, unless you have a limiting procedure, which was worked out in the last century by Maxwell and by Levy, this arises in the number of struts you need in a bridge to make it rigid. And the question is, what happens if you put too many struts in? Well, engineers are always putting too many struts into a bridge, so it's an important issue. And what Maxwell said is, you assume the strut is not rigid, but elastic, and then take the limit as the elasticity goes to, as the rigidity goes to infinity. But an alternative thing is to say that you've got to have an exact number of contacts. And if you go through it, it turns out that in the 3 dimensions, you've got to have 4 contacts. In 2 dimensions, 3 contacts. Now, if you look at, say that's a stress tensor, then this is the equation of force equation, d sigma by dx equals g. Look at that equation in 3. I meant that should be 2 dimensions, shouldn't it? Sorry. A symmetric tensor in 2 dimensions will have 3 objects. No, I'm wrong. I'm wrong. I meant three. Yeah. There are three. I'm trying to count my equations. The point is that this sigma in two dimensions has three components, and in three dimensions it has six components. And if it's got six components, here are three equations, so there are three more equations required. We cannot discuss the stress in a powder from that equation alone. What one does in most materials is have a constitutive equation. But there is no strain in this system, so there is no constitutive equation. There must be three more equations. Right. And in two dimensions, it's even simpler, because there's only one equation missing, and it follows that if sigma is a stress tensor, there must be a relationship which will go like A times sigma and B times grad sigma and C. These are tensors and so on, you see. So there's a missing equation. In an isotropic system, you can show easily that A and B are zero, so that's the first term that arises. Now, it's very interesting to see how one could derive such an equation. It's a real challenge to my mind. I mean, you can postulate the equation, but what would be nice to start with grains and actually derive it. But I may say this is a matter of great contention, because lots of people think that the number of degrees of freedom, the number of contacts isn't defined anyway. I believe there are four contacts. This is Edwards' contribution to science. Right. Now, it's a very good idea to look at particular laws. Most things in glass theory, you see, are very complicated. Here are some things that are very simple. I mean, throw them at you. Suppose we have a mixture of a material. These are polymeric materials, because the only thing simple enough to get an easy answer. There's 5.1% of glass with a TG1, and 5.2% of a glass with TG2. Then for the blend, 1 over the glass temperature is 5.1 over TG1. Right? It's a harmonic law. It's quite a decently well-attested law. Well, I have to be able to derive it. If the molecule's got a molecular weight m, you remember my diagram of the viscosity. Here's a relationship for the glass transition. Tg at m, it's quite easy to extrapolate it up to Tg equals infinity. And then it goes like A over m. And the question is, what is A? And why is it m? Why is it m to the power 1? Why shouldn't it be m squared or something? But it isn't. It's m.
Are these already understood?
I'm sorry?
Are these
yes, there are models which give them.
Okay.
Right.
Sorry, why is it Tg of infinity finite? I guess I'm confused.
It's if you had an M infinity, I don't quite know what you'd ever be able to do with experimentally, but it's quite easy to extrapolate. Yeah, all right, let me put it this way. dTg by the M is A over M squared, and I've just integrated it up. I don't think that's a problem. These symbols mean Vogel, Fulcher, Doolittle, Williams, Landel, Ferry, and they tell you that there's an essential singularity as you approach the glass transition in things like the viscosity and the diffusivity. And again, there are models which will derive that. And then there are much more subtle experiments and theories to do with light scattering and other things like that, and we'll be hearing a discussion of these in due course. I just bring these to your attention because it's surprising that they're not paid very much attention to in the literature. Right. Well, I think in view of the time, I have just a few other odd comments, but they're not very significant, and I'll leave it. I'll stop there, Chairman. Thank you.
Yeah. Up there. That makes perfect sense to me. So experimentalists say if you have polystyrene, any time the molecular weight's over 100,000, you don't worry about it. TG stops changing with molecular weight. Now, I don't know how to reconcile that with this other picture that you drew that shows the molecular weight occurring, and the glass transition temperature occurring as a function of the molecular weight. experimentalists would say if you have high molecular weight polystyrene, it doesn't matter what the molecular weight is.
Well, up to a certain molecular weight, there is a viscosity which is finite, and the stuff flows. Once you pass a certain molecular weight, it just jams.
Right, but if we determine the flash transition temperature by calorimetry, then whether we've got 10 million molecular weight or 1 million molecular weight, we have the same TG, but we have very different viscosities for those.
I'm sorry, your mind is working faster than mine is.
Well, I mean, the glass transition in polymers, it occurs where it does because of time scales, the local motions of the polymer.
Yeah, right, right, right.
And so it's that time scale that's important, not what the molecular weight of the polymer is. Once it's big enough that TG has stopped changing as a function of molecular weight.
I don't see that that's incompatible with all what I drew. I'm sorry, let's talk about it later. I'm sure what you're saying is right, but I don't find anything wrong with what you're saying. It's sure, that's how it is. Yeah, I've missed it, yeah?
I guess I'm missing something much more basic as to how an infinitely long polymer can have a finite viscosity at all.
Why isn't it always in the glass phase of the polymer infinitely long?
And so well, who said it did have it?
I get the temperature high enough that it starts to break and so on, obviously.
No, you're too fast now. What was the first statement?
Why isn't an infinitely long polymer always glass? How can I have a
But
glass?
It is.
But you had a TG of infinity.
But look, this is just the extrapolation of a curve. Look, I mean, the law, it's doing this. You know, then you say, well, there's a limiting barrier, that's all. Well, look, let me differentiate the expression. dTg by dm is a over m squared. Will you accept that?
This is empirically from experiments?
Yeah, sure. Oh, these are all experimental results. Sorry, I can't hear.
If you went to longer and longer polymers, it would ultimately come back up because the standing regard is really long, and you get a very high transition.
If the polymer, but the glass transition becomes easier and easier to achieve as the molecule gets longer and longer. That's all this says. It can't do anything else. If you make it longer, you can't.
Why should, if I take a
Very
long polymer, I have a certain TG, why shouldn't I take the polymer longer, the TG should get higher, it should get harder
It does, in the empirical law, it's a question of whether
it's a monomeric, the local monomeric friction coefficient, what the little segment of the chain is doing. That little segment of the chain doesn't know how long the chain is. And that sets the TG, what you tell TG of infinity. Okay. So that's the vocal culture piece, the EVA over T minus T naught of the TG in that temperature exponential is only dependent on local property, which is the local segment of the chain is moving. There's a pre-exponential, which is small molecules is n, and polymers is n is 1.4. Okay? The n shows up in two places in the vocal culture form. The pre-factor and the exponential. The exponential drops off pretty quickly because that's only done for local. The overall global motion is the big factor, that's right. This is like a that drives things back.
That explains
the polymers, you can be arbitrarily far away from TG of infinity and have your viscosity go through the roof.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you always see the inversion of the scale. You have to remember the answer here. Then two different places, two different regions. Overall motion and the global.
Well, thank you, Gary. You're much clearer than I am. Very good.
It was earlier on, I remember reading these wonderful papers that would come out of your group that kept talking about the powders and how you could come up with an analogy to the temperature. And I never, do you have a precise feeling for what this entropy is?
It's the number of ways you pack the thing in the box.
The number of ways.
You have sand grains. You have a volume V. And you ask, how many ways can I put the sand into the volume?
That's suggesting that the dynamics equally packs in all possible arrangements. And that's why you can just count the number of arrangements. I mean, there is this nice thing about equilibrium statistical mechanics that all points on the energy surface are weighted equally because of this
the ergodic theory. Yeah.
And we're making a similar hypothesis in talking about this.
Right.
Right. All possible ways of jamming those particles in that
occur with equal. Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, this is. What is the simplest hypothesis one can make? And the ergodic hypothesis, or whatever its analogy here, is the simplest one. Now, whether it's true is a different issue, but it's the simplest one. Now, if you pour things into a sand pile, you obviously have a texture. And the sand pile is not isotropic. If you look at the arrangement of the grains, they're not isotropic. And that would mean that if there's an analog of this kind of compactivity type of temperature, it will be a function of the way the sand pile was made. But in the kind of experiment that Sid did, where you're just shaking the powder all the time, then apart from surface effects of the tube that the thing's in, one would hope that the thing was completely isotropic, and the simplest hypothesis is to assume that the only thing you have is the volume and the number of ways you can pack particles into it. And so one can ride along and see whether that produces some useful results. If it doesn't, you have to produce a more difficult system. But there's one almighty jump between assumption that the only thing that matters is the entropy of the system and anything else. So I start with the simplest thing.
Have experiments been done with that salt and sugar and a barrier? Because that's the real test.
The problem is that, yes, indeed, they've been done, but I don't think they've been done at the kind of quality of the experiments that Sid does. And I think, really, that Sid's experiment is the one where the curves started and sort of non-ergodically, and then, you see, the you can produce very simple formulae to cover those. Now, I agree with you that I agree with anyone who'd say you're just producing a curve with one variable and that you're bound to win. But nevertheless, you can do that. You can work out the compactivity. In fact, you see, in Sid's picture, the density is one axis, and the other axis is in essentially the compactivity, this variable x. And then the curve is quite simple to calculate. But it's all... It's not easy to answer that. The question is, I think the thing that always worries me about it is that if you're going to shake a powder, you have two variables. One is the frequency at which you're shaking it, and the other is the intensity of the knock. And in ordinary thermal systems, whatever you do to it always comes down to one thing you do. But with the powders, you're doing two things. And I still find myself being very confused by that.
One thing you haven't mentioned is that the direction of the tap, that hasn't even been started to be explored.
Right.
As far as these compactivity things.
Right. And given a very strong directionality of the tapping, it's rather like doing statistical mechanics in the presence of a magnetic field or an electric field or something of that kind. And there are immense complexities and richness one can put into it. But I think we're at the level of Carnot or something at the beginning of the subject. And one really ought to look always at the very simplest things to start with.
Yeah,